Say welcome to everybody. We are honored that you chose this workshop to come through this afternoon, and our prayer that you might be ministered to during your time here with us. Thanks again for coming.
We have, our purpose today is twofold, maybe three or four, but two to be identified. One is to provide a safe place for non-gay family and friends to ask questions and be heard about any and all issues that relate to being non-gay and possibly struggling with what they believe all their lives about homosexuality, maybe caught in conservative Christian church, family, society in general. And the second is to provide a safe place for gay and lesbian people to respond to our non-gay participants. And just remember, it's okay to agree to disagree and continue to love one another. And I was going to say so much like that.
Okay. And I'm going to tell you what our purpose is not. It is not the purpose of this workshop to debate scripture. We find that that's meaningless and helpful and, I mean, hurtful, and many times just leads to arguments and nothing gets resolved. So we do not want to be scripture. We're not going to do that. And that's not a journey that we could recommend to everybody, but one that each one arrives to as the Holy Spirit leads them. We do want you to understand, though, that it's been through some difficult and arduous study and a lot of prayer that brought Mary Lou and I to the place we are now.
So, which is?
What is totally open and affirming
and accepting.
Yeah, just filled with love, that's it.
We also want to, I remembered what I was going to say. This is saying that we are open to any questions that you might have for us. There is no question that is inappropriate, so you may feel free to ask us anything. Most of you know, probably, that our 29-year-old lesbian Christian daughter committed suicide on February 28, 1997. She hung herself from the bar in her closet in a small town in southern Missouri. Anna came out to us in December of 1988, and we did not handle the news well at all. We were fundamentalist, evangelical Christians, and we just, you know, we had the same, we'd been taught the same untruth that some men here in this room have been taught. And we are finally to the point of being able to say that had Anna lived, we probably would not be here today doing this. So our desire on the way to her funeral was that her death not be in vain. And we didn't have any idea what that would look like. And we didn't think it would look like this, but we're thrilled that it does look like this now.
Okay, at this time, I think I'd like to have us go around the room, and each person could tell us your name. If you're comfortable, first name only is fine. And tell us where you're from and why you happen to choose this workshop. And know that everything that's said in this room stays just right here. It's a confidentiality. Nothing's going to be published or blabbered. So we're all.
Well, actually, it is going to be published. There's a recording. There's a recording that's going to go on the CD of all the conference.
Okay, so be careful what you say.
Yeah. It's not confidential.
Unless, like, people want to turn it off or something.
Or just don't identify yourself.
Yeah.
Or if you got something you really don't want anybody here, go put your hand in your voice. Have the person next to you ask your question for you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Dave, you want to start us off?
Sure. David Rogers from Houston, Texas.
I don't know why you chose this workshop.
I don't remember. I just remember listening to the list and I picked out certain workshops. I can't say why I picked out the next one.
You were in our very, very...
There's your chair, Steve.
Oh, yeah.
My name is John Aguilar. I'm from Desert Hot Springs, just outside of Palm Springs. And I'm here for a bunch of reasons, but I think I've heard from others about kind of your combined story and what you're doing. I'm really here to learn from you.
My name is Bruce Abney, and I'm from Desert Hot Springs. John, my partner, so it's kind of the reason, I suppose. And I, too, heard about your story and wanted to hear firsthand of your journey. And I also believe that God has put it in my heart to sort of just be available to people to talk with about what it's like to be gay, you know, a gay person who doesn't know yourself.
Great.
So,
I'm Shannon George. I'm from Laguna Beach. And I chose this workshop because I was hoping to be able to pick up from non-gays what their perspective is so that I can understand my parents better.
Mm-hmm. I'm Shauna from Laguna Beach, and yeah, I came just to hear different perspectives.
And I'm Brian from Santa Rosa, and I guess I picked this workshop because I'm very comfortable in sort of helping people come to understand sexuality issues of a parent to adopted children, and helping people understand that for 8 years now, because I've helped my daughter.
My name is Michael from Santa Rosa, and I think this workshop interested me because I just recently came out to my parents a year ago, and my father is very serious in his faith, very evangelical, and he's having a very difficult time. It'd be interesting to me to see how somebody like you, who probably were very much like my father, how you've come to the conclusion the view that you have today. Which is similar to me. I mean, I used to be very conservative in my thoughts of homosexuality as well.
I'm Dee Zoomer, and I'm from Apple Valley, California, up in the high desert, Mojave Desert. And I came because I admire Mary Lou so much.
My name is Clyde Zoomer, and I'm here with my mother.
My name is Ed Kennedy from Walnut, California, and I came because I wanted to understand other people's perspectives. A lot of time I hear people talk from the gay person's perspective of how they have to approach their parents, and I thought I might hear more of how the parents see the situation.
Yeah. I'm Steve Peterson. I've recently moved back to Boise, Idaho, which is where I was born and raised, and where my family is. And one of the reasons I moved back there was to maybe more actively engage them in this issue. It's too hard to do from a distance, at least effectively. So one of the reasons I'm here is to find out how to do that better.
Jeff Miller from San Jacinto, California. I've got a lot of friends that are straight that I'm not out to, and I just want new insights into how maybe to react to them if the subject comes up that I need to. So.
Mm-hmm. I'm Mark Middleton from Vancouver, Washington, in the Portland, Oregon area, and. Just want to hear the
non-gay side of things. I kind of want to hear some responses of other people's perspectives and discussion.
My name is Matthew Lett from San Jose, California, and I'm here partly because many years ago I came out to my my mother first. She took things fairly well. My father did not. He still, in many ways, probably still struggling with it. And I'm here just to listen to the dialogue and to hear the questions and answers. So just prepare myself for the future by having conversations with him. So just wondering.
I'm Rick Williams from Sacramento, and I'm in the process of coming out to family and non-gay friends, and I felt that this workshop would be instructive in hearing, you know, parents kind of process their feelings and reactions to their children coming out.
So. I'm Paul from Tustin, and several years ago, I read a book about the life and suicide of Bobby Griffith, and ever since then, this issue has been very close to my heart, and I just want to hear what people have to say.
I'm Lois Ziegler from Vancouver, Washington, and I'm here with my son. But I also want to, I just was interested in hearing other perspectives and hearing input from other people. And knowing a little bit about your story being in your family group, was hoping maybe more insight there as well.
And Kevin Lomaso from Concord, California. And just like Lois, to hear other perspectives from what I know.
I'm Jim Hutchison from Concord, California. I'm a pastor in the United Methodist Church. And I served on the Marin Suicide Prevention Board. And I'm interested in finding out what you think with the dynamics that led up to her suicide and what kind of dynamics might have contributed to preventing it.
I'm Russell Seymour. I'm from Dallas, Texas, and I haven't told my mom, so. And I'm her favorite, so. That makes it tough.
I'm Kathy Bosch. I'm from Panama City, Florida, Great Florida. And our son Ken is here, and he's gay. And we came to the workshop because Ken tried to kill himself several times. And so I'm sympathize with my life, but I had a better ending to our story. And I just want to hear more about it.
I'm Ken Wallace, and I'm, of course, a resident, and yeah, we're just a few heartbeats away from having some trouble.
Let me just give you a brief synopsis of how I got to where I am today. It started with reading Philip Yancey's book, What's So Amazing About Grace. In chapter 13, he talks about his long-standing friendship with Mel White, who, by the way, is here somewhere. And after I got done reading What's So Amazing About Grace, a friend of mine said, have you read Stranger at the Gate, Be Gay in Christian America by Mel White? I said, no. She gave it to me. She said, it's a fast, easy read. Somebody loaned it to me. You won't need it for long. And I began to read, and at the end of the foreword, written by Mel's ex-wife, Lila, I put it down and said I have to have my own copy. I gave the book back to her. I went super proud and bought my own copy. After I finished it, I emailed Mel, and a number of things happened. He invited us to come to the very first Soul Force event, an anti-violence forum in Lynchburg, Virginia, with Jerry Falwell. He wanted us to come and tell our story, and I said, tell what story? I was not interested in going to talk to Jerry Falwell about it. But he persisted, and Mel is not a man to be turned down easily, and finally convinced us to go, and we had about 5 minutes to tell our story. I had 5 minutes to tell the story of Dan's death, and at that point, we were still of the belief that homosexuality was a sin, and I was raised in such a tight, closed, fundamentalist church that it was kind of the sin above all sins. So it was, that weekend was just
incredible for us, and it was just the beginning of our journey. But we met 200 TLBT Christians, and that really said something to us. We, you know, we had to try to say, okay, now what is this? Is this an oxymoron, or is this, what are we missing here, and all that. So anyway, we met a wonderful gal there, Dottie Berry, and she and I began to email after the Lynchburg weekend on a daily basis, truly, for months. And she really challenged me to go into the Soul Force website and read what evangelical theologian Luce Meads had written, and she challenged me to read Roberta Kreider's book, From Wounded Hearts, Faith Stories of Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender People and Those Who Love Them. And she said, write to Peggy Campolo and ask her about her journey. Many of you know who she is. And then she said, but most of all, study the scriptures, especially the clobber passages, as they're called. And so we did. We emailed Mel after that weekend, thanked him for paying our way, and he emailed back three words, do your homework. Okay. So we did, and it just was the most amazing journey from October of 1999 to Memorial Day weekend of 2000. And I was just finishing Roberta Kreider's book, and it was like, I don't even know what to call it. I just started saying at the top of my lungs to my husband, of course, this is it. Why didn't we see it? What was wrong with us? How could we have missed this? How could we have missed the fact that this is not a choice? Who in their right mind, especially in the Christian community, would choose something that would cause them to be hated, sometimes killed? Look at Matthew Shepard, you know, that kind of stuff. And suicide is the leading cause of death in gay teenagers. So that was our epiphany, I guess you call it. And Bob was just really close behind on that. And then we went to a conference in Illinois called Love 2000, Witness Our Welcome. That guy right there, Diane, Steve Pearson. And by the way, he really can sing, guys. then in 2001, I was a keynote speaker here. But one interesting story, which you probably won't hear tomorrow at the memorial communion part, that I want to tell right now, is that Dave Bishop, who passed away just recently, dear, dear friend of ours, he was in Lynchburg in 1999, and he and everyone else there heard me say not once, but three times, that I believed homosexual activity was sinful. Three times I said that, and those people still loved us. I loved me anyway. Anyhow, we didn't talk. Then in 2001, when I was keynote at Connection in Denver, Dave Bishop came up to me after my address and had heard of our journey and said, you know, when I read the brochure that came out and I saw you were going to be a keynote speaker, I just went, oh no, not her again.
Dave doesn't mince words.
So I'll tell you what, that was a forging of a friendship that was, I missed him more than I can say. And in 2002, we all went back to Lynchburg and had a Pride Festival, Soul Force did. And I'll never forget the morning we were gearing up for this, and we were standing in the foyer, and everyone else was in the church, and David came in kind of late, and he just put his arms around me, and he laid his head on my shoulder, and he just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed and said, why do they hate us so much? So Dave and I had the privilege last year at Connection. He had lymphoma. He died of renal failure after a bone marrow transplant. But he and I had the privilege of sitting together in a concert that Saturday night in Connection last year. So that, I just wanted to give you a little bit of a thumbnail sketch about how we got to where we are.
There are just a couple different sidetracks on my journey that are a little bit different than Mary Lou's. One being that my background was not quite as solid or fundamental situation. I was raised in the Catholic Church. However, the churches that I went to weren't really preaching every weekend on how homosexuals are so hateful and they're all going to hell. It wasn't their number one sin issue for them. They would, I know what the Catholic Church stand is, their official posture is, but that wasn't what was happening to me personally in my faith journey. So I, not having had all of that bashing and exposure, I was more oblivious to the homosexual community. And so I learned it little by little, and as I was growing up, I would hear my high school buddies making comments about gay people, but it really didn't trigger anything in me. I couldn't see what was so hateful about the whole thing. And then following that Lynchburg, our first Lynchburg experience, and when I got to meet so many really nifty people, it just made me really think about the segment of community that I was missing out on, that I hadn't experienced before. And so we went through our journey, and as Mary just says, the minute it clicked in our brains that this is not a choice in any manner of fact, it was, from then on, it was just love and openness, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. It's just been great. We've been to so many different places and met hundreds of people that are great. And I think we can speak for both of us, but we feel that meeting and coming face to face with so many great GLBT folks is what really convinced us how wonderful that population is, and that segment of the population is. And I think that's a key to getting anybody to come around in their thinking. They need to know people personally and identify that. So I've heard a number, as you went around, a number of people asking about wanting other opinions and other perspectives. So if you feel like you can share that, let's open that up so that you folks can talk to one another about where you are and what's happening and what questions you might have.
Brett's up with Tracy, is that the term? She needs to return.
Hey! I do get Tracy that term.
Okay, just myself, is that better?
Oh, yeah,
okay.
It's
okay, I'm stable, and I'm just going to get busted. Well, I'm Tracy Fletcher. I'm from Southern California, currently. Let's see. My folks took it very poorly. And I was interested, I'm pleased as punch to see so many families represented with Shared Connection. It's something that we've been praying about throughout the entire year. And I was up here to support my community. We've been very wonderful friends to started being part of the easy thing.
I have a question.
Yes.
You said that you probably wouldn't have changed your mind if things hadn't worked out. Do you have any ideas of how we can help people who would be like you would have been, change their mind?
Before they lose their child or their...
Or, you know, just... Because it creates walls in relationships. Like my sister, you know, doesn't have any... Yeah.
There's more than one way to lose a child, where I said,
One of the things that we often say in our talks is it's so hard to be patient with our loved ones that don't get it. It took me 12 years to get it, and once I got it, I wanted everybody to get it overnight. What was wrong with them? After all, you know, I mean, I've got it now, so everybody needs to get it. I need our church to get it overnight, you know. And I think the hardest thing is to be patient. And we often suggest that you say to your, once you're, you've made the declaration, somehow that if you're going to come out to your families, you're going to have to say it. Then you can say, I am willing to answer any of your questions, but I won't force it on you. I will wait to be asked. It would mean a lot to me if you would read this or that, but I'm not going to force you to do that. It's a very hard thing to do, to be patient. And we've heard many, many stories of gay people that have just blasted their folks and their families, and that really doesn't go anywhere very well. And it, but it's so hard to be patient with them. But, and the other thing I would say about that, tell them that you'll wait to be asked. If you begin to receive abuse of any kind, verbal, emotional, whatever, you can also make a declaration that you will not be the subject of that abuse, and that if that continues, that you will leave their presence. And you may have to cut off some contact for a while. That's a hard thing for me to say, because Anna wrote me a letter 6 months before she died, and she told me she wanted nothing more to do with me. She said I had done colossal damage to her soul with my shaming words, and that she did not want to and did not have to forgive me. And that if I wrote to her, she'd return the letters unopened. If I called her and it wasn't an emergency, she'd hang up on me. And that's how it ended for me. She died. That's how it ended. It's like the proverbial thing where, you know, the husband and wife have an argument before the husband goes off to work and then gets killed in a car accident. There's no chance of reconciliation. So we had no chance of reconciliation. And everyone told me when this all happened, she wrote me this letter 6 months before she died. They said, you gotta give her the space she's asking for. Well, what would I do now? Grab my credit card, toothbrush and car keys and drive to wherever she was and tell her I love her no matter what. But I didn't do that. And now I never can. So it's just a matter of not pushing myself hard. Yes.
After a suicide in family, loved ones always feel a tremendous amount of guilt, and I'm interested in how you handle that, how you walk through it.
6.5 years of therapy. the man that I counseled with for 6.5 years was extremely, amazingly wonderful, supportive Christian man, evangelical Christian man. And he said to me, you need to figure out what part you did play in her death. You need to figure out what it was, because you weren't the whole reason for it.
Right.
So you have to figure out what part you did play in it, and then you have to ask for forgiveness from the Lord. And I did that. And certainly I still had moments of, you know, thinking, oh, if I can tell you honestly that I can go stand at her grave, and every time I do, I cry and I say, oh, I just would have known then what I know now. But I didn't. So yes, guilt can be crippling, but God had a different plan for us than for us to be crippled by guilt. He had a ministry plan for us, so.
Part of what he did for me was make me angry. I had a great deal of anger initially after the suicide, because I didn't realize that was such an irreversible act. There's no way you can go back and change the circumstances on it once it's done. And it just devastated us. And Mary Lou was experiencing such severe sorrow, and her life was just ravaged by that. And that made me angry that that had been done. And I had to work through that. And I did experience guilt along the way as well. So.
Can I tell you that when Kim tried to kill himself, and I tell him later on when he got better, why did you do that? I mean, you know that there's always better. He said, I was in so much pain that the only way I could see getting out of the pain was to kill myself. And at that time, he was not thinking about us or whatever else. He was just in pain. Mm-hmm. And if I can say that to you, your daughter was in pain. She probably was not thinking my parents don't love me. She's just thinking I'm in pain and the only way that I can get out is that way.
Mm-hmm. Did we answer
your question? Yeah. Oh, Clyde, one other comment I'd like to make is that often we don't understand or realize just where the other person is, like your sister, for instance, where they, what they're thinking and how far along they process the information. And it's hard to tell where they are on their journey. So this patience that Marina talks about is very important, that they need some time to process some of this stuff before they can interact.
I think they're caught up in the clog of passages. I think that's where her and her husband, I think they're just bound up in those.
That's one thing that's so frustrating. It's been, I mean, Martin and I have been together 20 years. You think our witness, you think God knew something.
Or you think at a certain point, can't we agree to disagree on this one thing and have a relationship that,
you know? Well, I think we are there. I mean, it's sort of, but it's, I just always expect the Holy Spirit to do more than
it does. Get them out of those clobber passages. They're in a Presbyterian, strict Presbyterian faith that we just hang on to that clobber stuff.
Orthodox.
Yeah.
You both mentioned that as part of coming to terms with everything, you realized that it wasn't a choice, that nobody would choose that. And as we went around the circle, a number of people are in the process of telling their parents. I've heard of parents that come to that same conclusion. They realize it's not a choice, but they still have a preference for abstinence or other types of things. How do you respond to parents that, or to people that have parents that sort of fall into that camp?
Well, I don't want to make a joke out of this, but Dottie Berry, this friend I just told you about, we talked about that when we were so struggling with our own beliefs, and we said that to her, at least you have to be celibate. And she just looked at us and she said, well, I will if you will. And I don't think that was God's design. I mean, I think if it's not a choice, we certainly don't advocate for promiscuity. We certainly do advocate for monogamous, intimate partnerships, mm-hmm. marriages, please. I'd love to see legal marriages everywhere. That's real shaky ground, I think. Mm-hmm. Expecting any segment of society to be celibate. I mean, it's pretty clear in the scriptures that that's a special, special gift mm-hmm. from God. Mm-hmm. And very, very few people have it.
Mm-hmm. I think those parents need to realize that for a heterosexual child that they have, they would want them to have love and a happy life with a partner. So why wouldn't they acknowledge that would be a good thing for their homosexual child, since it's not a choice with them anyway?
I have something I need to bring up real quick, actually. I need to correct something, actually, in terms of what I shared earlier. When I came out to my father, he was very calm. He sort of gave me sex 101 education right there and talking about, you should only date one person, not too many at the same time, and really try to be with this person for the rest of your life kind of thing, which I thought was really good. Of course, later on I heard through my mother his sort of opposing thoughts on that and about my lifestyle per se, so it was very confusing for me. And at that point in time, I don't recall, maybe one other conversation shortly thereafter coming up to him. But from that, we never really talked about it again. So I know for some parents and families, you talk about it all the time, but for me, in my situation, with my father especially, there's a lot of silence. And so I'm wondering, how do you feel about that? I mean, do I need to make the first sort of move or to talk to him or something, dialogue? I think partly for me, I'm still kind of afraid and fearful just because, you know, it's a very sensitive topic. So it's kind of something I can throw out to the group.
Some of you respond to this.
Do y'all live close together?
Yes.
Well, if you did like my son and you lived on the other side of the United States, then, you know, you'd be glad to talk to your son. Because that, I mean, I don't get to see him but maybe once or twice a year.
And when they first come out, I mean, you know, it's going to take a while to adjust to that. And,
right.
I don't know how long it's been.
It's been about 4 years, so maybe
it's
needs to be a little longer.
It'll be an ongoing process for a while. We're still working, you know, I mean, a lot.
And to be honest with you, there's no doubt in my mind that my father loves me. I'm sure he loves me too.
Well, that's something
I love him as well.
So, you know, like, when hearing their story and just coming to this conference and everything, you know, the first night or two, I don't know if it was last night or the night before, but a lot of times I wish my parents would, you know, reconcile, come to this. And I'm thinking, well, you know, if you think about it, most of you, all your parents, very, very few exceptions, and maybe no exceptions. I mean, you know, they never accepted their daughter until it was too late. Your parents perhaps won't accept you, but in time maybe they will, if it's God's choice. But the thing about it is, they love you. Take it. They do love you.
Matthew, you and I have a lot of common father perspective coming up. My mother was extraordinarily vocal for a number of years. My father was very stoic about it. And I thought that he had taken it okay initially, but I remember one time he said, and we haven't addressed this either, but he said, I will not stand in the corner and cry and have a beat party about this, but don't you ever think for 1 minute it's okay. And we still haven't addressed that. His actions have somewhat addressed it, but I haven't been able to sit down and say it's the thing you're still eating. It's a fear thing, but I don't question what you said. I know.
You know what? They still love you. Love your child, no matter what. You still love them. Even y'all still love them. I mean, you know, she's the one that wrote you the letter, and it's sad as it is. Eventually, hopefully, that one day you will have a relationship. And the hardest thing for me to do is be patient, but that's what you said, that it doesn't happen overnight, and it hasn't. I had to drag him to this conference. I mean, I had to drag him. And he was looking for every out there was.
You know, it looks like the heels on the slip box are pretty
good. So, you know, that you know. But, I mean, he really...
Well, my dad never... I mean, I told him, and we never had a... I don't know how he dealt with it, you know. I gave my mom books to read. My dad doesn't read, you know, so... But, yeah, that's... But, you know, he wouldn't be interested in reading about gay things, or...
He reads stories.
But, you know, a couple of years later, I introduced him to my partner and shook his hand. You know, I knew things were okay then.
One thing I was thinking, I have a suggestion for you people. I know when he told us and then he was going to come out and talk, he talked about bringing Martin out to meet his brother and his sister out here. And I said, no, I don't think you ought to do that because they'll say, Martin's to blame. They will never be able to have a good feeling for Martin if he, you know, meet him at the same time. So he held off. Martin didn't come out. He came out and told his brother and sister, and then they got introduced to Martin later, which worked out better because I know what would happen. They'd have just pointed their finger at Martin. We hate you. And it didn't work that way because he didn't bring him, and they had a chance to think about it. Then we're more able to accept him.
No, they like him better than me.
So there you go.
Exposure to, bring back to your question, exposure to friends that you have, that officially engage with multiple students. Because from your dad's perspective, there's a lot of emotion caught up in the fact that it's you. And having a chance to meet other people, quality people, friends of yours, in fellowship, I've said it to them, I share a name or something, and you know, broaden horizons slowly. And that might help. I know in my parents' case, they've met a lot of friends that were gay and lesbian, and that was helpful for them.
That's good to know.
That's good advice. And I had, here's another, let's lighten it up here a minute. We knew a number of gay people before Anna came out to us, and we just loved them. We had this one restaurant, this one favorite restaurant that we would go to almost every Saturday night, and the server, we got to be good friends with him. Was he gay? Yes. Hello. And the organist at our church, hello. We just loved these guys. But boy, when it came to being my daughter, that was a different story altogether. Totally different story.
And you're right, the silence is very painful. You'd rather have them dialogue with you and try to process, but the silence is deadly.
Could you expand on that? What is it that's hard to take about your child being gay? What is that? What's the feeling of that? Is it a fear or a regret? What is the feeling that a parent has?
In a way, it's a loss. You feel like your child's not going to be what you had planned for them, what the life that you hoped they were going to be. And you realize that that's not going to happen.
I cried for the grandbabies. I knew that he
would be wrong and help them.
Well, and I was convinced that what my church taught me was true, and that it was a sin. And the letter, she came out to us in a letter, and the one I wrote back wasn't very pretty. It was basically, you know, I will love you, but I will pray every day that you'll change your mind and your attitude. And I mean, I went through the whole cycle. First of all, I prayed that the Lord would bring a wonderful young man into my life. You know, it just, then I think, well, maybe that's not the right. Well, at least just don't let her have any partners. You know, it was just the whole, yeah. But it was all because the way I was raised and what I was taught in church, it fit right there. And I believe with all my heart that what I was taught was untrue. It was not true what I was taught.
And parents, have a problem sometimes because a lot of parents dream about grandchildren. Mm-hmm. You know, and all of a sudden they say, no grandkids, you know. Mm-hmm. I was ridiculous. I was married and had two daughters before I became gay. And you know, and my wife, my ex-wife now, you know, and sometimes I'll say to her, well, you know, they should be a grandmother and you don't have to worry about that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What do you think is the most effective thing as far as the transition you made from believing that homosexuality was sinful, from going from that to accepting it? Was it studying the scriptures, or was it meeting gay people in person, or was it just deciding to have a more loving attitude toward these people, or?
It was a really big struggle. I don't want to tell you. I'll tell you what, we read everything we could get our hands on. We talked to people on both sides of the issue. We prayed. I cannot tell you how many times I was on my knees saying, God, are you sure it's okay for me to change my mind about this? And for me, and I'm not especially proud of this, but
had the desired result. For me, it was really, really important to talk to other non-gay people who had already made the transition. People like Peggy Campolo and Lou Smeads and I don't even remember who, Philip Yancey, who has not quite come out with that transition, but he, you know, just those kinds of people that, I mean, I loved listening to my gay and lesbian brothers and sisters because I'd come to love them, but that 9-month journey, it was almost like having a baby be born, you know, that journey I had to just keep going back to the non-gay people and saying, you know, well what about this, and what about this, and I emailed with Peggy and Lou Smeads, and just I had to keep going back to those people because I had such high regard for them.
Yeah, they have a great Christian faith, and that was part of where we needed to be. We needed to not lose our God over this, and so we were able to talk with them and find our way.
Question for you both. Is there any, do you ever do, I know you might do the what if, but did you ever imagine what your life would be like if Ann had not committed suicide and where you'd be today and what that might look like? And the second part of the question is, how have, I know how you've grown in this issue, but how have you grown spiritually through this? What your relationship with God?
How are we growing spiritually now?
Well, I have how have you?
During my spiritual growth, it's not been a steady incremental growth, as you might suspect. I've had a spurt where I really feel I'm growing rapidly and gaining much more personal relationship, and then there'd be dry spells for me. And since I've come to my transformed thinking, my spiritual growth is accelerating, and it's just growing exponentially. And I can't explain why that took place, but for me, that's what's happening for me. I'm feeling much more closeness to God, and it's through the people that I associate with, and I see such great Christian walks in the people around me, and that's so encouraging to me.
And Dan, you know, it's a pretty hard question to answer, where do I think I would be if she lived? But I'd probably still be living in Chicago, going to a fundamentalist church and still condemning her. You know, I did love her. I did love her. And even, believe it or not, we allowed her to bring her partners home. We allowed them to sleep in the same bed. So when you talk about guilt, I mean, we have some friends now whose families won't even allow them to bring their partner into their home. Their parents home. We did allow Anna to bring, she brought two partners home, and one she brought home twice, and she offered to stay in a motel with her because she said she was used to sleeping in the same bed with her, and that was a real tough one. But we decided that we wanted to have a relationship if we could with her, and so we let her stay with her partner in the same bed, in the same house, and all of that. But I'm one of those pendulum people. Spiritually, with the whole advent of our changed beliefs, my evangelical Christian pendulum had to go way left. It had to go way left for a while. It's pretty much coming back to the middle now. I would say it's back to the middle, but I just had to be really on the edge for a while, because I was not real happy with a God who would have allowed me to grow up in a family and a church that taught me the kind of stuff that killed my daughter. Mm-hmm. I didn't like him very much for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did all this experience affect your relationship with each other?
This man, they threw the mold away when they made him. He is a saint, and you know, I don't know if you know the statistic, but 80% of people, parents that lose a child, are divorced. Mm-hmm. 80%, that's a real high percentage. Mm-hmm. And we are in a second marriage, so Anna is not Bob's biological daughter, she's mine, but we've been married for 25 and a half years. He literally, and it didn't tear us apart. It didn't tear us apart. He just was there for me every minute of every single day.
Well, we just looked to each other for support and encouragement to get through this whole thing together. We knew we could rely on one another to carry us when we got weak. And Anna was only 10 years old when I met her, so I grew to love her pretty intensely in the years that she was with us. So even though she was not my biological daughter, I had a great deal of love for her. And we just decided we were going to work through this together and not let it tear us apart.
Do you have any other children?
Yes. I have two other children from my marriage, a son and a daughter. My son has two children, my daughter has none, and then Mary Lou has another daughter from her first marriage.
Okay, you don't have any of your own that,
we don't have any
that would be affected with this?
No.
Well, my daughter was pretty seriously affected by it because it's her sister. Mm-hmm.
Does she hold any blame for anybody?
No. That's a real interesting story, and I'll make it really brief, but she was really, really anti-gay. She had a lot of trouble with her sister being a lesbian and put all kinds of stupid rules on her, like, you know, you can't kiss her nephew on the mouth, and you can't put your fingers in his mouth, and just junk like that. And when we began in 2000, we started a Bible study for gay Christians. So many people that are marginalized by the church and don't have a church home, we just had a Bible study in our home. And I got a letter from my daughter just raking me over the coals for this. I know we're supposed to love them and everything, but have them in your home? Well, and the beautiful part of the ending of that story is I wrote a book. And Becky doesn't read anything, but she read this book. And now she introduced me at a people meeting where I was speaking in Springfield, Missouri, which is the town where Anna lived and died. And my daughter Becky introduced me with words of all of her own writing that were the most profound and tender and loving. Oh, it was just unbelievable.
People can change.
People can change. Mm-hmm. We're pretty positive.
I do remember a while. But I'm not really sure exactly what it is that I'm looking for, because I've already been through this whole journey. And anybody like y'all probably wonder what I'm doing with my parents, my in-laws, everybody's on board. But at least they were. And my parents are starting to convert. And it's the weirdest thing. I don't even recognize them anymore. It's like they've gone through so much with them on a 30-year journey together. And they've been very, you know, reconciled. And my dad's a Baptist preacher. Now they've moved up to Ohio, and they're part of the General Association of Brother Baptist Churches.
I do.
And they're just surrounded by these hate mongers, for better words. And I just think that these guys are being so influenced. And I mean, I'm hearing my parents say things that I haven't heard since I was a child. They went to Bob Jones University, so they have a lot to work through. But I can only say this, like my mom's last year, I don't think the gays should be allowed to marry or adopt. And thinking, who are you saying this to? You know, it's like, I mean, I've been married for 15 years. And she told it to my husband. And it's like, I put up with so much for a year, and we just went. Finally grew up, I've never ever loved another. And it's had to, this is, you know, their attention should be sort of missing. It's amazing, right after our argument, a 4-hour conversation, she walked back to Patrick and said, you know, is his drugs making him angry? And I just, Patrick was just so dumbfounded. He's just like, no, you are. And she's like, I still don't think that the gay should be allowed to marry him. And thank God Patrick didn't tell me until after she left, because I was like, God, in 4 hours burying my soul and crying, just let me know what's going on in your life and you're living back to this person. And it was just like, I'm just trying to figure out what, you know, because it's almost like going back to where we were in high school. And it's like, who are they and how do I reach them? And it's just very weird.
I think you put, you hit the nail on the head though. She ARV Baptist, okay? Yeah. And if they moved and they're now under that influence again.
It's hard to overcome that.
Yeah, I mean, I know I'm looking at it. It's overbearing.
I'm sorry, David.
Mm-hmm.
How can we help fundamentalist churches to wake up and smell the coffee? Because there was a study done some time ago in Scotland that showed that suicides among gays, particularly gay young people, was higher, much higher, than youngsters that had been brought up in fundamentalist churches, and caused all that conflict in their lives.
It is the leading cause of death in gay teenagers. Suicide is the leading cause of death. How do we get the churches to wake up and smell the coffee?
See the answer to that.
I'm not sure just what would work in that aspect, but I can tell you what you and I are doing. We've formed this not-for-profit corporation called Teach Ministries, and TEACH is an acronym for to educate about the consequences of homophobia. And through that program, we are attempting to get into as many settings as we can to just educate people and let them know that their homophobic attitudes are killing people and are making people's lives absolutely miserable. And if we can just influence a few people in each setting and get them to start thinking about how badly they're acting and the terrible things they're doing, we'll feel like we're making some progress, making some headway. How you get to a specific church and convince them that they need to wake up, as you say, smell the coffee in this, it depends upon the particular administration in that church, what their attitude's going to be, because obviously they're running that church and they're the ones who are influencing their congregation. So if there's a way to get the ear of one of those people and try to get them to understand, that's one little inroad you might be able to make.
I think more and more parents involved, that's accepted their children and see that, no, they're not really weirdos, they're really, you know, people just like us, because they were participating. And our input was in Alabama. And our church is thinking about leaving the Episcopal Church, because our diocese is, because of the gay bishop deal. And so it's like, well, if I do that, well, there's a church, you know. But I really think that you need to get more and more parents involved, or whoever you can involve that has the guts and the strength to just meet with them and talk with them. Meet with the parents, meet with the children, as young as you can get, with administrators, because, you know, children in school and everything, just, I mean, to let them know that, you know, this is not a choice that these people make. This is, you're born this way. And this is, and I mean, I just think getting more out. And it's God's time. I mean, God's going to have to work. More prayer, I mean, you know, that's kind of simplistic too, but didn't you say, oh, she's kind of, that they had prayed for more parents to come, yes, and more parents to come? Mm-hmm. So I think maybe next year they'll have even more parents. And so the more parents that you can get involved, I think.
The other thing that we've discovered, and this goes back to what we talked about right at the very beginning part, is that the church has to have, or whoever, whether it's a church or your parents or a sibling or whatever, there has to be some sign that they want to at least be a little bit receptive. You go into a, you know, if we're going to go into Focus on the Family, you know, we're going, Soul Force is going next year, but there has to be some sign of them wanting to look at the issue. We had an experience about a year and a half ago at a congregational church in Illinois, and the pastor there, a delightful lady, heterosexual, but had a real love for gay people and wanted to see her church become an open and affirming church. So she began to teach a Sunday school class in this church, and very, very slowly and carefully and gradually brought these people in the church along. They studied it. She didn't preach about it on Sunday mornings. They studied it in Sunday school. They had home studies about it. And then after several months of that, she brought us in. And on a Sunday afternoon, I told my story. And 6 months later, they had a unanimous vote to become open and affirming. Mm-hmm. So there has to be a readiness. You know, you've got to have some fertile ground here. The rocky ground is going to get very far. Yeah.
It's a very, very slow process, but if you can get somebody behind it to help it along, there's a chance.
What do you think of the Soul Force approach now that you've been doing it for these years?
Well, we love Soul Force. We tell everybody, and we've been very severely criticized by certain gay Christians because we are involved in Soul Force. But we tell people we cut our teeth on Soul Force, you know? And their approach is different. It's like trying to compare apples and oranges. If you try to compare BC and Soul Force, you just can't do it. They have two totally different focuses. And the Soul Force focus is one more of social justice. And we don't go to Washington and lobby because we don't have the energy for that. But we try to get to at least one Soul Force event a year. We were there in Indianapolis at the Southern Baptist Convention in June of this year, and I got to tell my story with a microphone three times out on the street as these beautifully dressed Southern Baptist women and men were going into the convention center, and everybody, all the Soul Force people were wearing Soul Force t-shirts, but I got to wear a dress so I'd look like a Southern Baptist. How big of a deal it was. Some of the criticism of Soul Force is that they are an interfaith movement. There are Jewish people, there are Muslims, there are, you know, and Buddhists, and we don't, we're Christians, but the people in every religion, gay people in every religion, are being discriminated against. It isn't just Christians. It is Jewish people and Muslims and lots of others. So we like their nonviolent protest. I can't remember if I told this one story about. I think I might have told my family, but it's so terrible. In 2002, when there was a Pride Festival in Lynchburg, the first one ever, and we had our usual Fred Phelps contingent and the likes of
carrying signs and bullhorns, yelling, "God hates fags," and "Repent or you'll burn in hell," Matt Shepard, "Burn in hell," all that stuff. And we had this festival going on, and every 5 minute speakers, every 5 minutes there was a new speaker of music or something. And I really had a big argument with God that afternoon, because I was supposed to be one of the 5 minute deals, and I just didn't think I could speak over those people. And they carried a banner that was 30 feet long and 10 feet high that said homosexuality is a sin. But I God won the argument. And I did get up there, and I didn't know what I was going to say. I prayed as I was walking up to the microphone about what I should say. And what I said was, and Bob went with me, moral support here. What I said was, you know, 4 days ago would have been my daughter's 35th birthday, but she's dead. And I said it just like that. She's dead because of the untruth I was taught by the church. She committed suicide because I did not accept her and love her unconditionally because she was a lesbian and she was a Christian. And then I said, my daughter is dead because of the teachings I was taught by those of you at the top of the hill with the bullhorns. And we bumped into Mal White after this Pride Festival, and he said, did you happen to notice that when you started talking about Anna's death, that the hecklers stopped altogether? They didn't start again, not until the next morning.
Really?
Wow.
I'm curious about how you or if you ever did talk with Anna's friends and what transpired in those phones, and the same feel. And I just want to say I just really admire your courage. It was so difficult for us, many of us here, to come out to our folks and to have you come in the middle of the year. We totally get that. You know, it's tough. So, you know, our prayers are with you too.
But, that'll yeah. Let me tell you the one story that is just such an un-storyteller. For a few years, I had known that I had to go back to Springfield, Missouri and make amends with Anna's friends. I had to apologize to them for the way I treated them at her visitation and the funeral and the burial. And I finally had that opportunity on May 16th of this year. The Springfield people I invited me to come, they knew why I went and what I wanted to do. And we got there, and I really hoped that some of her friends would be there, but I was scared to death that they would be there. And we got there and to the meeting place on that Sunday afternoon, and we were trying to set up the room and stuff, and my daughter, Becky, that's where she introduced me, she beckoned to me and she said, "Mom, come here a minute." And I went over and she was standing with this woman and she said, "Mom, this is Susan Nichols." And oh, my heart just stopped and my breath caught in my throat. I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to take another breath. This was the woman that Anna was with when she died. Actually, they'd had kind of a little tiff just before Anna died. This woman never had a chance to make it right with Anna either. And so this woman had sent flowers, and she was there viewing Anna the afternoon of the visitation before we were. And I'll tell you, you want to see smoke coming out of somebody's ears. I was furious that anybody could get in there and see her before we did, but this woman did. And so I didn't like her very much. And she was really, kept moving her flowers close to the casket. We kept moving them away. I was absolutely angry about that at the visitation. I didn't shed a tear. I was so full of anger with this woman. And she stood in front of the casket with her three children. And just finally I said, "You have to move. You know, there are other people that want to come up here and see her too." Well, this was the woman that was at this peace-like meeting, and she said she wanted to talk to me in private, and so we went out the hall, and she said, sorry for those of you that write her in the story, she said, "I just hope that you're not planning to dishonor Anna's memory by making her suicide all about her being a lesbian. Do you deny that you abused her, that you sexually abused her?" I felt like I'd kind of just slammed up against the wall. And I just said, you know, I know what she told you. I know she told you that I abused her in every way possible, and I did abuse her verbally and emotionally, and I admitted to that. I did not sexually or physically abuse her, but may have felt to her like I did. And of course, she had told all her friends that I did. So you're not gonna tell, you're not gonna try to correct a person who's dead. You know, somebody, the person who died told him something, I'm not gonna be able to change their mind about that. So I had some really tough moments then. I started to cry, and this woman was, apparently had come only to confront me. She wasn't planning to stay for my talk and everything, and I pleaded with her to stay for my talk. I just, please just hear me out. And she said, all right, I'll stay, and I'm going to sit on the front row. I'm going to just read this because it's a little easier. This is real hard. I have built into this particular talk an apology and a request for forgiveness. And here's what I said. Some of you have struggled long and hard. You have read many books and articles, and some of you may have even prayed that God would heal you of your homosexuality. Speaking of healing, I am aware that some of you here today knew Anna. Thank you for coming. I am also aware that it must be pretty hard to trust my words. In fact, you may think I've totally missed what Anna's suicide was about. I believe Anna told you that I abused her in every way, verbally, emotionally, physically, and sexually. If that's what you believe, it would be nearly impossible to change your mind, and I won't try. I readily admit that I verbally and emotionally abused Anna. I did not physically or sexually abuse her, but it may have felt to her like I did. I ask for your forgiveness. If you are not able to do that yet, I hope you will someday find it in your heart to forgive me. I admit I don't deserve it, but that's the nature of forgiveness. It's a gift of freedom we don't deserve. I would also like to ask forgiveness for the way I treated many of you at Anna's visitation, funeral, and burial. I'm grateful for your presence here today. I went on to finish my talk, and at the end, I always open it up for questions and comments, and there were a few questions and comments, and I was standing off to the side of the podium, and all of a sudden, this woman got out of her seat, and she walked towards me like this, with tears streaming down her face, and held out her hands to me, and took both of my hands in hers, and said, I forgive you.
Oh,
I forgive you. And we held each other and cried, as about 40 people looked on.
Wow.
It was a very healing moment for Mary Lou to have that happen, to see that reconciliation.
Don't you wonder if maybe she had some guilt on her tip?
We talked for an hour, and she had terrible.
So I would say she probably was holding against you to keep the guilt off or something.
Any more questions or comments if people would like to exchange here?
I have a question. When I found out you were doing this workshop today, because of stuff that Pam had taught us in the women's retreat, I got up the nerve to call my parents and invite them. Not really thinking that they would come, but I didn't want the choice to be mine. I wanted it to be theirs. Mm-hmm. So I made the call, and of course my dad, when I asked him, he just went silent. And then he was like, well, we really got to finish putting our bedroom back together. They're remodeling it. We really got to finish doing that, which is what my mom had said too. And so I just told him, I said, well, you know, I just wanted to let you know that this was going on. It's at whatever time. And these are just some parents. And I just thought that it would be a good resource for you. Now, I had done two Clyde. You know, I'd given my mom Peggy Campolo's keynote, and I think that I gave them Mel White's book. And I'm pretty sure that they hadn't read anything. I've seen my mom read more books against homosexuality than I've even, well, look at this side too. And my sense is that they still are not really ready. So my question to you and to any of the other parents in here too is, you know, what maybe is my next step?
Don't get my father.
Well, I'm not going to do that, but I also don't want to be real pushy, and I don't want to be overboard with it. But I also, the last time that I even had any kind of conversation with them was years ago. And so at the same time, I don't want it to be years down the road that anything else comes up. But I want it to be like you were saying, in their time. But
as long as you keep trying to be in touch with them, if anything ever happens to them, that you'll know that you've always tried, so because you would feel guilty. But I would say that it's just hard to get through. It's just hard to accept, because, you know, and it's don't give up on, because your parents love you. It's just, like you said, it's not the life that they wanted for you.
Mm-hmm.
And but they still love you no matter what. So just don't be pushy. Just say, we're having, because I mean,
kids. Right.
You know,
well, yeah, and I know that my dad asked me,
you know,
what did I do?
I was a married mother.
They don't want to come to a, you know, in front of other people and make some funny possible with that. That's part of it. But a suggestion, maybe get her book, if you hadn't done that, give it to them to read, and then come back and say, you know, I'm not thinking about killing myself or anything, but I have hurt, and I want, you know, I desire your relationship. And that's about all you can do, put it like that, and maybe it'll come around.
And you might be able to just say, remember last week when I invited you to come to this workshop? Well, here's the people that were in the workshop for the book.
And here's the CD.
And you know. Here's the CD. Buy them a CD of it. They might put it in the show, and they might listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
I got lots of Christian books too. My brothers and sisters have sent to me about how bad it is. You know, it's like, this is really strange. I was like, after the shock, you know, I'll take my son anywhere way you can get him. When you see him on a ventilator not moving and not knowing if he's going to live or die, then, you know, you kind of say, I'll take him anyway, you know, and so.
I went through this craziness, you know, running
out. Oh, yeah, it wasn't one time he tried to kill himself. Once, for 6 months he did.
And of course, he was away from us when he was doing these drugs and things like that, you know, but I don't know what I was doing.
Oh, yeah, there's stuff we're finding out now that, like, he did the circuit scene and all that, because he was in seminary. He had graduated from Auburn and was in seminary. And he was always the perfect Christian son. And I could tell you that if your child didn't do this, or if your child was gay, it's because you didn't do what I did, because I was the right mother, you know, and everything. I did have one son that gave me a lot of trouble on the side, but, you know, because, you know, he's just a big boy. But anyway.
I know my son, you know, because he kind of blamed us with this happening, you know, and of course it's a long story and all, but rather than cut the communication lines, you know, try to leave them open as much as you possibly can.
Well, our relationship with them actually has improved tremendously. Like, whenever Sean and I have been together for 7 years, and whenever they met her, my first partner was not very nice, so their first exposure to me being gay was being in a relationship that really was not very healthy.
Mm-hmm. We've seen not so desirable people that I've sent them around with.
Yeah, so I think that whenever Sean and I got together, they basically were expecting it was going to be the same kind of thing. But last year we were able to buy a house up in Big Bear, a vacation home up there. And I called my mom and told her, and she goes, oh, goody for me! So they actually have come up, well, one of the things I was going to say is whenever we first, whenever my parents first met Shauna, I mean, my dad would hardly even shake her hand and speak to her or anything. And, you know, now they'll come to our, either one of our houses, and they'll actually stay with us in Big Bear and spend the night. And we only have double or queen size beds, so. So there's been a lot of improvement that way, but, you know, my mom has said things in the past about just pretending that our relationship isn't what it is. And so, and that's kind of how they get through. And so I knew that calling and asking them to come to this was going to bring up the reality back up to them again. So there has been a lot of improvements, and we have been, and the relationship has getting better. My dad will talk just with her. I don't have to be right there, and he'll hug her, and my mom does that too. And my mom says, wow. She said to me one time, she goes, wow. She goes, Shauna is so nice to us. So that's really making a difference, and really, my prayer for them is you know, because we grew up in a very fundamentalist church, and you know, I just have in my own life have experienced such a much more freedom in God, and having a bigger God than I had when I was a kid. And so that's my desire for them, is for their God to be bigger, so that their relationship with God will be enriched, and therefore their life enriched. And then just to further, you know, bring whatever wall or whatever that might be between us, so that our relationship can be even better.
I think what you did today was very courageous, and especially because it's been a while since you've talked about any of this. I think that was a really good thing to do, a courageous thing to do, and you can be sure that they will be thinking about it. And you might want to give them a little time to just process the invitation, and then just, you might even say at some point, how did it feel for you for me to invite you to that?
How about your parents? Do they know each other? I mean, your parents know her parents?
No, not really. Although, because my dad has met Shauna's parents, and my parents are pretty accepting to me.
So there's not the barrier there.
No, I mean my parents aren't Christian, and so it's a very different scenario, I guess.
How do they feel about your Christianity?
They think it's kind of weird.
And they should
be
too.
I think, well, how can I get my parents to come here, and because it's a Christian organization?
all these
You know, it's interesting to me that the people that I've come out to this last year, the only people that have a problem with it are the fundamental Christians, whether they're family or friends, and other people who don't know Jesus. That's something they're missing, I think. But they don't have a problem with my being gay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's just the opposite. Christians are supposed to be loving and accepting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't get it.
That's
where
Jesus was.
I had an experience about 2 weeks ago. I was talking to a former neighbor of mine down in Visalia, and just kind of asking her how the homeowners association was going, because I'm renting out my condo down in Visalia. And she was bringing up the issue of dating, and we're gonna have to find you a woman, Rick. And I've known this woman, my neighbor, for 8 years, and I just told her, I said, well, you know what, I play on the other team. And she was just so great. She's not really a Christian. She's more Church of Religious Science, but you know, she was just so affirming. I said, "Oh, that's wonderful! I didn't know you were gay." And so I was, it was nice to receive that affirmation.
Sure.
And it really emboldened me
to you know, be more courageous and, yeah, and being real with people.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. Sorry to say, I think our time's expired here. And let me just make a comment. On the table over here, there are a number of resources. We have a list of extensive resource material. There is a pamphlet, a handout there of a dialogue with Philip Yancey and the editor of whosoever.com.
Whosoever.org. Candace Shalhoub is a website, and she interviewed Philip Yancey. We have copies of that.
And that interview is tremendous. That's really a great thing. We have Soul Force pamphlets.
What the Bible said and doesn't say about homosexuality. There are stories in that.
There's some brochures of our story, our own story, and our ministry.
And we have
some business cards, two pieces of those up.
Sorry,
I was thinking. We have a book and two videos and a CD of Anna's songs. They're all in the Resource Center. This is the latest video that Mary Lou made, and it's a video of her talk at Cathedral of Hope in Dallas on Mother's Day 2003. It's pretty good.
This is her CD. This is pricing this would be more.
Yeah, it's her first video.
And Roberta Kreider's also on this one. She's a little Mennonite lady whose brother was gay and died of AIDS. This is Joe Killen's book, Young and Joe. Mm-hmm. The Psychology of Grace. It's excellent. And then this is mine. There's two editions of this. There's a CD edition which has Anna's songs in the back, and then there's just the regular edition. So. Yeah, it's all the paper stuff is free.
Yeah.
Thank you all.
Thank you.